Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday, October 15, 2012. We're going to be talking finances. Finances with regards to the TSP in general, but very specific as to the life cycle funds and how they work. Talk about inflation and taxes on your investments, and an interesting subject, pay off your debt or invest in the TSP, umbrella liability insurance and bundling. And to bundle all that and make sense is John Gillick, certified financial planner, financial advisor. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
And John Elliott, federal benefits expert, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, but still email answerer and guest co-host of the radio show. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob and John as well.
All right. And for the rest of you all, say good morning to Andrew, the ever-efficient engineer. Good morning, Andrew. Anyway, okay, John, let's start at the top. TSP Investment Choice Overview.
Okay, Bob, this is something that we teach quite a bit through NITP in classes, and I start out with folks saying that the TSP, without a doubt, is one of the best accumulation plans for retirement, and with that, you have five basic fund choices in there, and I'll ask that question. I'll say, well, how many choices do you have in the TSP? And folks will commonly say, well, you know, six or ten. And, well, they are choices. The L funds themselves are just another way to deal with the GFCS and I. So when you look at the plan itself, you have five basic choices, and then the L funds are an automatic process or an automatic way to deal with the main choices that you have, the five index funds.
Okay. And thanks for reminding the folks and me that the program is brought to you by NITP, Inc. It's a retirement planning mid-career, beginning career seminar presenter only to the feds for the last short 29 years. And we do the show. There's no commercials, and we're just here to educate you, as John started with the TSP investment choices. Now, I'm a tax finance type, but I do talk about the choices, certainly not like you do, John. But people go, well, that's the stock fund. That's risky. And I go, well, they're kind of sort of all stocks other than G and the F. The C is a stock fund. The I is a stock fund. And the S. What's the difference between the C, the I, and the S? They're all stocks, aren't they?
They're all stocks, but they deal with different areas of the market. So your C fund will model the S&P 500, your 500 largest stocks on the New York Stock Exchange big board. And in that, when I teach, your companies are Heinz Ketchup, McDonald's, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, Johnson Controls, Aflac. And as I tell folks, I mean, if you think about it, and 3M is at the top of the list, if you type in, and I always like having folks type in into Wikipedia, the list of S&P 500 companies, because when you really look at that list and you start to scroll down, the first company on the list is 3M. And it's the running joke when I teach that, you know, if Post-it notes ceased to exist, if 3M went out of business, the federal government would screech to a grinding halt. And so when you look at that fund, you're dealing with the largest of the medium-sized U.S. companies, and there should be really no fear for folks to have money invested over there. And when you look at them collectively, the dividend yield on those on the S&P 500 trends around 2%. And at a time right now where you have the G fund paying out a little over 2% with very little upside, meaning growth, the C is really a very logical place to have some money now. And when you look at the economy, I'm bullish on the economy. I think things are actually going fairly well. But if you look at the S&P 500 companies, they're sitting on several trillion dollars in cash right now. And you'll hear that in the news, and they're sitting on it to see which way things are going to go. But I don't think you've ever had a better chance for upside than currently with a fund like the C fund. Now, the S and the I, the S delves into small to medium-sized U.S. companies that are not included in the C fund. So diversification-wise, you can really spread your risk out by, and also your potential return in the future by moving into those other areas. And then the I Fund is international stocks of 21 developed countries. And so large international, primarily large and medium international companies.
So each one of these three funds, while stock, are, I don't want to say solid stock, it sounds like a recommendation, but they're not a stock on a startup. They're not a stock on maybe, quote, a risky one. But, you know, sometimes solid ones can become risky when they have not such great years or decades.
And the I Fund, correct me if I'm wrong, but I was told this, does not include emerging economies, international economies.
That's correct.
And developing countries, just the developed countries, which has been criticized as a weakness by one of, not your colleague, but one of our other financial planners that does the seminars.
But so is it coverage both in the U.S., the C Fund, is 500 of the biggest U.S. companies, right? And the S Fund are smaller companies, but sometimes when people hear they hear small, they think of the gas station down the street. Well, it's not that. It's huge small companies, right?
That's correct. What troubles me is that just from a financial planning standpoint, a lot of classes that we're out teaching now are for mid-firs, folks that are in the middle of their career. CSRs, CSRs, a lot of those folks are in the retirement phase now. Either they're doing it or they're thinking about it strongly. But for the folks that are in that mid-band, what really troubles me is that you're at the lowest tax rate since 1950, and that's from J.P. Morgan's data. I'm actually looking at that now. And you're at the lowest tax rate since 1950. A lot of folks may not feel that way. But the reality is, with the debt that's lingering out there, that taxes most likely will go up before they go down. Interest rates will go up most likely before they go down. And when you look at the cut sheets, which are available on the TSP website, as of December 31st, 2011, the net assets in the G Fund were $147.7 billion. And I'm going to flip a couple pages of my material. The same information for the C Fund assets were $71.5 billion. So the flagship fund, what should be the flagship fund of this plan, the C Fund, because you're trying to accumulate wealth. This is an accumulation plan through your career. You have almost double the amount of assets in the G Fund, which is the Play It Safe Fund. And with a yield right now of slightly above 2%, you're historically below the inflation rate, which is 3%.
Okay, when you say yield now, the yield on a stock would include not only it going up, but do they put dividends in there?
But in the C Fund, they do, and the dividend yield on the C Fund is right around that 2% mark now.
Okay. And probably if we're not having the best of times, certainly not having the worst of times, but those dividends tend to stay fairly constant, don't they, of those companies?
Well, they do, and typically with your dividend payers, it's the ultimate death sentence. We have a running list that I work off of for stocks that show companies and how long they've paid dividends and how long consecutively they've increased the dividends year over year. And some companies, Johnson & Johnson, have done that for over 30, 40 years, where they've paid the dividend, increased the dividend consecutively year over year. And if they were to suddenly stop that trend, or if a dividend-paying company said, hey, we're not going to increase and or we're going to cut, that would have an immediate effect on the stock in the market. So,
okay. Now, for those of y'all out there listening, we are live. It's 10:15. It's October 15th. Ooh, it's October 15th as well. And we'll be on for about another 40 minutes. And you can call us, and we wish you would. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Now, when the show goes off, it will be archived on the website, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you probably shouldn't call past 11 o'clock on October 15th. That's a.m., because we won't be here in spirit, but not on the radio.
Well, Halloween is this month, so
okay,
we got a lot of spirits.
All righty, so now dividends, again, for the folks that are listening, dividends, it's not like interest. A bond pays interest. A savings account pays interest. A government security pays interest. A dividend is a payment, correct me if I'm wrong here, John, payment of the profits from a company they don't pay them all out, but they pay a certain percent out to attract investors and to reward them for their investing in the company. Is that a fair summary? You can tell me no.
No, it's a fair summary, and I'd also say it's a sign of stability of a large company that they've made it to the point where the profits are in excess of what they need to run the company, and they're able to pay that back out. So any cutting of a dividend or any other direction than increasing the dividend is a sign of potential issues maybe with the company.
Okay, so if we got 500 of the biggest companies and the other ones in the S fund, the value of that investment isn't only based on the value of the stock going up. It's also you're getting paid in the interim, even if the stock stayed constant via a dividend.
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm not so sure everybody understands that.
No, and I would agree, and that's I try to keep it real basic when we're teaching that too at a different facilities. And what's nice is that you do have the dividend, and then you can think about the market. I always like to say the stock market is exactly opposite of what happens at Walmart. And if you go back to 2000 and 2002, and if you were invested in the TSP plan at that point in the C fund, and you had $100 in there, your $100 as of January 1st, 2000, by the end of 2002, had declined roughly 54 cents. And the decline was because the C fund companies had lost that much in stock value. And I teach off of that decade from 2000 to 2009 just to show folks that that is without a doubt the worst period of investing in the history of that fund. And the reason I say the market's opposite of Walmart is that if everything today was on sale at Walmart 54% off, there would be a lot of folks maybe calling in late to work and maybe going to Walmart, because if you can imagine everything in the store, fishing poles, clothing, food, TVs, 54% off, folks would flock to it. And if you go back in Federal Service, and folks chuckle about this, when things in the C fund or the C fund itself was 54% off, folks did exactly the opposite. They ran from the store, meaning they ran away from the C fund. They shifted to the G. They took their future contributions. They kept them the same. They didn't increase them. And for the folks that hung out in the C fund during that period of time, not only were their paycheck contributions or payroll contributions continuing to invest in those companies when they were down, they also had that roughly 2% dividend yield, which wasn't cut across all. Most companies kept their dividends in place, and even some were still increasing. So they were accumulating, there's a word again, accumulating more shares when times were really tough. And that's really what you have to do in this plan, is you have to get into some of these stock funds but stay in for the duration. And if you look at that decade overall, you had the dip 2000 to 2002. That was brought on by the technology boom or bust. And then later in the decade, I think maybe the folks that were trading the penny stocks had found something called real estate, something that in everyone's mind was the most stable investment, we'll call it that for now. And that bid that market up, houses were going significantly higher than their actual worth. And then when that all came crashing down, it almost took banking with it. So that kind of activity, two horrible economic events within one decade, is very rare. And so it's very difficult as an instructor in that area to get folks to look past that. And I get the common objections, well, what if? And it's interesting, if you G and F are the bond funds. They contain loans, be it government loans, government agency loans, corporate loans in the case of the F fund. But when you go CSI, I always tell folks that stands for crime scene investigation, because that's who you'd like to call when you look at your account statement and your stock funds have declined 10, 15, 20%. And it's difficult, but I think with the proper training and folks just branching out a little bit and getting some base information on what they're investing in, the choices, I think it clears a lot of that up, and then they're able to then accumulate for retirement.
So when you work with your clients, it's not only investing, it's psychology. So I'm going to be the nervous Ned and say, John, if I do this, I had to work very hard to get that money, and with my luck, it'll drop 10% within the year after I do it. How do you talk me off the ledge?
Bob, it's the biggest challenge I face, and it's the psychology aspect that really humbles you sometimes, because you could be the best salesperson in the world, but when it comes right down to it, getting somebody to take that first step is truly a leap of faith for a lot of folks. And I was teaching a class last week, and I just had one person in particular, and I think that even if I had several hours with her, I mean, a lot of the answers I was giving, I could tell, just weren't being reflected back, because she had such a reluctance to be in the market that in some cases it may be better for them to stay on the sidelines. And in the case, and I've experienced this with folks that are very, very conservative, they also live very, very frugally. So as long as you don't have someone that's conservative that's spending every dime that they make and then two or three more, it might work out all right for them. Risk is something that, risk equals return. The more risk you take on, of course, the more return. And it's really, I think, the challenge as a financial planner for working with anyone is finding out, where they lie on that continuum. I mean, how much risk can they really take on? And usually it's just baby steps. We're going to move them forward slowly.
Yeah, if you had pulled out of the stock market in 2008 because you panicked, since 2008 to current, the Dow, which was below 7,000, I think, at one point, in the dark days of 2008, is now almost 13,500. The S&P, I assume, is also done very well during this 4-year period. So if you pulled out, you didn't reap all those years of the stock market essentially more than doubling since its low point of 08.
That's correct.
And so that's the risk. If you these people were selling low, and then maybe when they started to see it go back up, even as early as 09, I think it was starting to go back up, then they were buying high. Just the opposite of what you want to do as an investor. So that's the psychological part of it you're referring to. It's just, bad way to invest, obviously.
All righty. So, good point. So the folks listening now are going, I'll consider this or that. The folks in the classes that we teach, they walk out and go, But we could segue into another bullet point that you have here that I find interesting. For somebody that, like you mentioned, that might be very cautious, but they're a spender, and they may have accumulated credit card debt, or they may have accumulated some type of debt that's certainly greater than what their cautious investment in the G fund. I'm not talking against it. But let's say we're paying 8, 10, 12, 18% on credit cards. When do we say to ourselves, I think it's time to pay these things off, and maybe I'll ignoring the FERS match, maybe cut back on my TSP contribution. I know I'm going to get an angry call with that. But if you're paying 18%, if you're paying 10%, that's coming out of your pocket. Whereas if you make an investment and it's yielding 2, 3, 4, or 5%, seems to me the better thing to do initially is to pay the debt off if you can. How do you educate an individual that would otherwise not understand the money dynamics there?
It's difficult from the standpoint that if you have somebody that is in that debt, really the first part of the analysis is, how did you get there? And it's a little bit of a meeting of the minds to say, is this a chronic problem? In other words, we have a chronic spending problem. Or did they just end up in circumstances where, everyone's home equity was up, everybody's value was up? If you went in to get a mortgage, on a house, they'd basically look at you back in that mid-2000s period and say, well, Bob, you have a job? Yes. Do you think you can afford a house of $600,000? Sure. And they'd lend Bob the money. And, of course, that's what got a lot of folks into trouble. But I think that that free credit spending spree that a lot of folks were on became epidemic nationwide. And what I really sit down is I try to boil down to how did we get here? In other words, meaning how did that particular person get into that debt? And if we identify that it was just circumstances beyond their control, then and that they're not out there actively spending and borrowing to buy more nice things, then we look at potentially a loan against something like the TSP. We look at other ways to reduce that debt. But I really say to folks is, you know, hey, let's take a look at how much you're saving into the TSP. With FERS, of course, they're giving you a 5% match. So without question, 5% is the magic number for contribution out of your paycheck to get that 5% match. Another way to say it is for every dollar you put in up to that 5%, it's 100% return on your money back into your retirement plan. So I wouldn't ever want to see someone cut their contributions completely to start working on the debt issue, but I would like to see them cut it down from, say, if they're at a 10% contribution out of payroll, cut it back to maybe 5%, get the match, and then let's take that extra 5% that you had been putting into TSP and let's go ahead and eliminate the debt problem.
Could we borrow money from the TSP to clobber some of the debt?
Actually, you could, and I'm going to let John speak to that a little bit, our benefits guy, because there's pitfalls there.
Yeah, the TSP loan program sounds good to people because, A, right now interest rates are low. I looked it up a few months ago, but I forgot what it was, but it's real low. So that's one, attractive feature to people. But the other attractive feature is when you tell them, as you pay it back, and you can only pay it back, you pay it back through payroll deductions, it goes right back into your TSP fund. So you're not paying interest to a third party. So that all sounds all great, except every piece of advice I've ever heard about borrowing from your retirement fund is don't do it. And because if you're pulling money out of your retirement fund, out of the market in effect, you can really do some long-term damage, correct me if I'm wrong, to your retirement outlook. So I'd be very, very reluctant to borrow from your TSP fund or your 401k if you're in the private sector. So even though it sounds good, it can have a very bad effect on your retirement outlook.
You're 100% accurate, but I think I have an end around. With the ability to transfer money between the funds, one can do it pretty much as they so desire. Correct me if I'm wrong.
On a daily basis, yeah.
Okay.
Just don't do it.
No. Just if I'm going to borrow now some money, not all of it, from my TSP, and exactly like you say, I don't want to really borrow it from the funds that are making money, why don't I transfer everything to the G fund right before I borrow? I borrow X dollars, comes out of the G fund. After I get my loan, I put it back in the other funds.
But you're still interrupting.
And for a period of time, not a long period of time.
This is, well, depends. You can get a residential loan, primary residential loan, and you'd have 15 years to pay it back. A loan for any other purpose, you have 5 years to pay it back. And I have a feeling a lot of borrowers take the maximum amount of time.
But after I made the loan, I start with $1,000 and I borrow $200. I got $800 in there, but it's all in the G fund. And as soon as I get my $200, I move that $800 back to where it was before I consolidated.
Well, let's ask John. I mean, let's say you pull out of the stock market for a few days or a week or a very short time. Can that potentially, depending on the market, have a bad effect?
Well, John, it can if you miss some of those best days, and normally the market...
And you never know if you will or won't. That's the problem.
Yeah, best days, best weeks, and there's study after study on missing those days and the effect it has long term. But I think what Bob would see, and maybe what I'm driving at too, is that if you have someone that has a significant amount of debt that they just can't seem to get beyond, and they've truly taken on the fact that they're in debt, they've maybe had some spending issues, they've got that under control, it's the consolidation, cleaning up of that. What I do like about the TSP loan for cleaning up debt issues, if someone is serious as part of a larger plan, is that it's coming out of their paycheck. They don't have a choice. So the repayment's going to be, as you say, on a non-purpose or non-real estate loan, maximum 5 years. It's going to come out of their paycheck. They're going to get a rate of return. And if they had a large chunk, as Bob said, sitting in G, and it's a comparable interest rate, then they're not really going to be affected. And rarely do I see folks that are primarily in CS&I, the stock funds. I see a portion that's sitting over there. I'm not going to say stagnant. That's a bad word. But it's sitting in G where they're getting a very low rate of return anyways.
If they could get a loan from another source other than a retirement account, would that be preferable if they could secure a loan, even though they're paying interest to back to a bank third party?
Home equity loan or home equity line of credit. Well, absolutely. But the problem we're running into now is that those home equity lines of credit may not be available. Mm-hmm. So if we're dealing with
I'm just saying if they could.
If they could, right.
And, then you would you advise going that route as opposed to borrowing from your TSB?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely.
Yeah. And plus the interest on a home equity loan is at least tax deductible.
That's correct.
So.
Okay. Now we've kind of got the near term in focus, understand some of the opportunities that we have, but how about looking to the future? The effect of, and this is off your bullet points, effect of future inflation and taxes on your investment decisions now. We could spend 2 days on that, I suppose.
I think we can. I briefly touched on it when we started out, but... you know, with a tax rate at a 50-year, I mean, since 1950, lowest tax rate.
I mean, we're talking about money outside of the TSP at this point.
That's correct.
The listeners, I know you and I are.
Right.
Okay.
See, without getting political, so this is a tough one. But with a tax rate lowest since 1950, if you just put a little thought into it, taxes are going up. They're not just going up on the wealthy. They would go up on everyone. And when I'm teaching, you really look at taxes in this country, and 70% of the tax is paid by the top 10% of taxpayers. And I think as a CPA, Bob is rolling his eyes back a little bit there. He knows this. And it's interesting, the top 10% of taxpayers starts at an income level that maybe not that well known. It actually starts at $113,000. In $18 in adjusted gross income.
So if you're like a GS-13 government employee, you're in the top 10%.
That's correct.
Of the country. If you're making just $34,000, I read the other day, you're in the top 1% of the world. Now that's kind of a silly thing to, but it's true apparently. But anyway, if you're maybe even a 12, I've lost track of what the pay scales are, but several steps high in a 12, you may even put you into the top 10% of the country in terms of earnings. So that's kind of encouraging.
Well, and you're right. And and we can talk about politics a little bit, but the number that's been thrown out actually and agreed to by one side or the other is that it's 250,000 and up. Those are the folks that need to pay more in tax. But the top 10% of taxpayers paying roughly 71.2% of the tax, it starts at $113,000. And, I mean, we can throw in the extra $16, but, you take dual-income government.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of times when I'm teaching class, mid-furs, I mean, if you have a dual-income government or you have one person is government, the other one maybe is, doctor, nurse, attorney, you pick it. That $113,000 number is not very high. And then to be in the bottom 50% of taxpayers, the top of the bottom 50% as of the beginning of this year was $32,870 in adjusted gross income. So another way to say it is 50% of the folks in this country that pay tax make $32,870 or less, and they pay roughly 2.9% of the federal tax.
So the point being is taxes are...
Going up.
I would say for everybody, and we don't only talk to the Beltway, of course, we talk outside the Beltway.
Correct.
But the numbers you just gave, I don't care where they are, people are going to be impacted. So if you don't have the money in the TSP and you have it outside and you haven't maxed, it's probably better to max it and keep it in the TSP, because outside of it, whatever investment return you might get that's taxable gets hit. Now, it might get hit at a favored rate like dividends, or if you buy and sell stock, which is very hard to do. I'm sure you would agree with me, John, that the days of the trader are legendary, but not available for most. Most people, if you're working, you can't keep your finger on the trigger of what you do on the job as well as what you're doing in the market.
Well, it's difficult to be a trader, and I think the best example for that is that Warren Buffett, this guy that's known for buy and hold investing, and last I checked, is number one or two in net worth in the world. And, you know, on the top 500 wealthiest folks in the world list, last time I checked, no day traders. So it's a very difficult business at best, even with a tremendous amount of training. And no one in that arena, day trading, has risen to the top of the list.
But. Yeah, Warren Buffett was asked a question on television a year or two ago. I was watching it and said, if you could give investors one piece of advice, what would it be? And he said, find a mutual fund, stock fund, and just leave it alone for 20 years. So that is one piece of best advice. If you could only give one single piece of advice, that would be buy and hold for 20 years in the stock market.
And I would absolutely agree. And that I kind of want to segue back to the TSP and the investment choices. It's a perfect intro to the life cycle funds. And I do, when I'm teaching or just meeting with clients, run into a lot of folks that feel trying to time a good move from the G to the C or from the C to the S and the I, they're wrapped around trying to make these strategic moves based on the economy, politics, and there's professionals that would tell you straight out, and I'd tell you the same thing. It's difficult at best to do that. And it's nearly impossible is probably a better way to say it. And for the average person that's trying to tackle the TSP, I've got a love affair now with the life cycle funds, because I've been teaching long enough and have had it fielded enough questions that the life cycle funds are a clear choice for folks that do not have a lot of time, do not have the financial training to be able to make the decisions on where to move it. And even for the folks that have a lot of training that can make those decisions and move things around, they make clear sense too, because you're now dealing with an automatic process. And I actually have the sheet from the L funds, and in class I actually read the first paragraph. I tell folks we're going to do something very odd. We're going to go ahead and read the first paragraph of the sheet. And it actually says the L funds diversify participant accounts among the GF, CS, and I funds using, and I love this, professionally determined investment mixes, and they have in parentheses allocations. And when it says professionally determined, that's not John Gillick, certified financial planner. That's not Bob Lyons, certified public accountant. They actually hire these folks, I believe, called CFAs, chartered financial analysts, and they spend their time analyzing investments. Excuse me. And with that said, they've determined these allocations that are tailored to different time horizons. And when you look at that, it's when your expected retirement date is, which would be about the time you're going to start drawing back out of those funds to live on. And it goes on to say the L funds are rebalanced to their target allocations each business day. Now, I do this professionally, but even for my own 401k, I could never imagine going in every single business day at the close of the market and making the minute adjustments. Say the C fund was down that day, the S was up, the I was slightly down, and the G and F popped up a little bit. I'm not going to go in every day and move a couple shares here and a couple shares there, but with the L funds, that's exactly what's happening on a daily basis.
And that's a good thing?
It's a good thing, because as we said earlier, you don't want to miss out on the best days of the market, but there's good days and there's bad days.
So they're doing that to maintain the percentages among the five funds.
That's correct. And maintaining those percentages, study over study out there that shows that maintaining your original percentages based on your risk tolerance and then having those adjustments made frequently, in this case, it's making those adjustments every day as necessary.
Okay, now we're talking about the the life cycle funds.
The life cycle funds.
And then let's drill in there a little bit more. A life cycle fund isn't just a fund. Don't they come in different colors?
They come in currently the L income, which would be someone that's retiring imminently.
But do they do that by year or decade? Or
It's by decade. So L income would be current, L 2020, L 2030. L 2040, and the furthest one out is L 2050.
So let's say the L 2020 would probably be the most, if you will, protective type investing, because we're not maybe as much into stocks as we would be if we were in the 2050. Is that the way it works?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I think as I recall, I was in the 2020 for a while, and it started out with 65% in the three stock funds and, of course, 35% then in the two bond funds. But each quarter, a slight amount gets more conservative. So as you move along the continuum, every quarter, and you can go to the website, and they have a little thing, interactive thing you can play with to see how it works, a little more money will shift out of stocks into bonds. I mean, it's slight movement every quarter, not great movement, but you'll see it. And the theory is, as you approach, get longer and longer in the process, you're going to want to be more conservative and safer. That's the theory behind the L fund. So by the time, I guess, if you stayed in the 2020, eventually it would be, you know, a majority of the investment would be in the bond fund. So... yeah, it's for people, not only for people that don't have the sophistication, but also people who don't have a financial advisor like John, for example. Now, if you're going to work with John, maybe whether you need to be in the L fund or not, John can tell you.
By the way, John, how does one get in touch with you?
Well, actually, two ways, Bob. Phone's always useful. You can reach me at 301-704-0544. That's 301-704-0544. Or always by email at TraderJohnJ. The last letter there is my J for Jillick. at gmail.com. That's TraderJohnJ@gmail.com, which incidentally has nothing to do with investing. It had to do when I started on eBay about 12 or 13 years ago. So, and Trader John was taken, so I had to throw the last letter in there. But but yeah, then the L funds, I mean, it's all laid out on the very first page. And as John just mentioned, it says the investment mix of each fund adjusts quarterly to more conservative investments as the fund's time horizon shortens. So I really, really like the L funds, and I get that question a lot. Well, if you were in the federal plan, what would you do? And I said, well, I would make it as easy as possible on myself. I rarely look at my own 401k, maybe once a year if the market's been doing really well, to see what my number is. But I don't get in there and shift the investments, because I've got my original mix, and my plan allows for a quarterly rebalance, and it's an automatic process. This L fund has a daily rebalance, which I would prefer. And I would actually be in the L funds if I was in this plan, and most likely based on my target retirement date. Now, this is with four kids, probably 2050. But that just has to do with paying for college and weddings and things like that.
Yeah, so the younger people want to be in, like, if you're first coming into government, if you're young, 2050 for sure is the one for you. And if you're coming in late, or you've been in government a long time and nearing retirement, you may want to go to the L2010 or something like that, or L income fund if you're real close, I guess. But the one thing that seems to bother me about the L income fund, which is about 80% bonds and 20% stocks, as I recall, is you, and correct me if you think this is wrong, that seems to me awfully conservative too early, unless you're intending to take that money out, say, at retirement. But there are a number of people who are not going to touch that money at retirement, or going to take it later, maybe not start, maybe only take minimum distributions at 70 and a half and keep the rest invested in the TSP, which is core to my plan. I haven't touched my TSP account. I've been retired 10 years or so. And there are people like me. So I don't want to be 80% in bonds. I want to be more like 50-50 at my age.
But you can buy within the L funds. It doesn't all have to be one or none, correct? I could say, okay, I want half my money in the 2020 and half the money in the 2030.
Well, you could do that, but in effect, what you're creating is a 2025. So you're creating one in the middle, and I get that question a lot. Well, you know, I'm not going to retire in 2030 or 2040. My goal is 2035. And I go, well, if you want to be very accurate, we can put half your money in the 2040, half in the 2030, and we're creating, in effect, a pie chart or a fund right in the middle. And I think that John's right. The L income fund is there. I believe it's there as a fail safe for someone that has not taken the steps to look outside later in their career as to other options. And I am a big proponent of once you get to the 59 and a half point, where you're able to do what's called an in-service distribution. And you use TSP Form 75 to do that. That you get the majority of your money the heck out of the plan. And when I started out, we were talking about accumulation. When you get later on, closer to retirement, and you have the majority of your money, say in the case of FERS, some of these folks will have in excess of $500,000 in this plan. You're dealing with five investment choices versus what you could do out in what's called a self-directed individual retirement account. Or a self-directed IRA, and out there you have every stock, bond, mutual fund, every insurance project, every insurance product that they've created. And a lot of those products are very good and give you a lot more leeway from an investment standpoint than the five choices that you have within the plan. But I wouldn't stake that alone. I wouldn't do that unless, A, you have a decent base level understanding of the investments, and you have somebody that can assist you, a financial advisor, financial planner that you've got a relationship with. And I see a lot of mistakes happen at that point where folks are moving their money out of the plan into one investment, one annuity, one product. And I have a very difficult time with that because that's not diversification. That's usually something else, meaning that the person that's doing that transaction or helping them with it is steering them into maybe what's best for them. And so I spend a lot of time on that when I teach. And I tell folks, if you're at the point where you're 59 and a half, you're going to be maybe in service for another 4 or 5 years, I would sit down with a planner, sit down with an advisor to discuss your options at that point with respect to moving the money from the plan. It's not an option, not a decision I would, make lightly, and it's something that should be, well thought out. But it definitely is a good move in that you should be much more broadly diversified than the five options in the plan at that point.
Also, if you move into an account you're talking about, when you're withdrawing money, you have more withdrawal options than you do with the TSP. For example, you can take vary the amounts of money you take out on a monthly basis, at least, if not, or some months if you don't need money, you don't have to take it. Whereas with the TSP, you have to commit to, for example, an equal amount each month, and you can only change that once a year, up or down. So, yeah, not only do you have the infinite number of investment opportunities with, say, an IRA, but you also have more flexibility in withdrawing, which can also be good.
That's correct.
All righty. Now, your last bullet point here, I think we hit the TSP from all different angles well. And you have umbrella insurance and bundling. Okay, I think I understand umbrella insurance. I don't know that I understand bundling.
Okay. Well, we can tackle the umbrella insurance first, and I tell folks when I'm teaching, I said, listen, there's there's a problem you have as a federal employee, and when you listen to the radio or you watch the TV, you get these wonderful things called commercials, and of course I've seen several billboards now in the area, and you have several firms, I won't name the names, but you have several legal firms that are out there advertising, you know, if you've been injured, if you've been involved in an accident and it wasn't your fault and now you're hurt, that hey, let's go after these folks, meaning, let's take them to court and see if we can recover. And that means a lawsuit. And when you look at, I have folks say, pull out their car policies, and it's interesting, if I'm teaching a long class, folks will go back at lunchtime and bring their actual insurance statements back, and a lot of times they'll see limits of liability on, say, an auto policy, $125,000, $250,000. And there's no umbrella. So what that means is I say, listen, if you're on the way home, let's knock on wood that this doesn't happen. You're involved in an accident. You were on your cell phone. You went through a red light and you T-boned somebody. It's one person in the car. They're severely injured, legitimately severely injured, meaning that, they get flown away by shock trauma. You got to stop in that case because you got hit by the airbag. You're all right. And say, what happens now? And what happens then is that, I'm not going to pick on the attorneys too much, but at some point in time, that person that's injured is going to seek legal counsel. And, when they find out that the person that did the harm, did the injury, is a federal employee, mid-career, late career, I don't want to say it's a cash register that rings, but there's suddenly a lot more that, for collection than, say, the guy working part-time down at Jiffy Lube. And what happens is that, let's just say you end up in court, there's $1 million lawsuit, the other side wins, your car insurance with that $125,000, $250,000 coverage is going to write a check to the other side for $125,000. They're going to shake your hand in court and say good luck. And now you, the federal employee, have an $875,000 judgment against you. They're going to go after your assets they can easily get to. Things like your house and your TSP are going to be protected, but the TSP only to the point where until you take a distribution from it. Your paycheck, say you're mid-career, you've got 15, 20 to go, they're going to send a notice in to benefits saying, hey, here's a court order allowing us to garnish your paycheck. So now you've got that garnishment for the rest of your career. You're not going to quit your federal job over this. But that's a tragic situation, and the umbrella liability insurance comes in over top of your auto policy, over top of your home policy, and typically they started around, my experience is $1 million is the initial level of coverage. It's about $10 a month from all the policies that I review, and that $10 a month puts you in a position where we have the same accident scenario. They can collect $125,000 per person up to $250,000 from your basic coverage. But now there's an extra $1 million that comes in there. So that same lawsuit scenario for where you would have been left with $875,000 is now being covered by an insurance policy. And for that low of a cost, in most companies, they require you to take your basic from, if say you're at $125,000, $250,000, they're going to require you to take that coverage up to $250,000 per person, maximum $500,000 per accident before they put that umbrella in. But at that point, that umbrella is really $10 a month, $120 per year. Now, if your situation is more complicated, meaning you have some rental houses, multiple vehicles, motorcycle, you may want to bump up to a couple million. So $1 million would be my experience with federal employees. That's the minimum recommendation starting out, but you may actually have a higher need. And I'm just shocked from a property casualty standpoint that insurance isn't discussed a lot more.
Does the insurance also cover damages to people on your property? You know, the automobile accident, yes. What about somebody that falls down the proverbial stairs or gets hit by the neighbor's rock that went through their lawnmower? These are all kind of goofy things, but right. would the umbrella policy sit on top of, like, the homeowner's insurance?
Yes, and hence the term umbrella. It's sitting over top of your automobile. It's sitting over top of your homeowner's insurance. So you forgot to chip the ice. You have the nice no soliciting sign. Somebody comes to solicit anyways. They fall. They crack their head. They're still going to sue you if they have unreimbursed medical expenses and it's legitimate. Well, they may sue you if it's not legitimate. So it's going to cover over things on your house. It's going to cover over your vehicle. It's not going to, I get this question a lot from federal folks. Well, if I have a liability at work, does it cover me? And the answer is no. And you'll have to read the policies, but that's almost a no in every case. You need professional liability insurance in that case. And that's an issue it's coming up more and more. And there's that insurance is available out there depending on your occupation and profession, but that's professional liability. This is strictly umbrella liability for harm that you have caused someone else.
John, this is a little too early in the morning to have a drink, but after that, I think I need one. But I'm glad you brought it up. I probably won't have a drink, but I'll have to call the insurance person. Anyway, we got less than 2 minutes left. This has been a really good final comments. And one more time, your contact point?
Contact point is 301-704-0544. That's 301-704-0544. Or at Trader John J, the letter J, at gmail.com. And just to sum up, I think that it's never too early to go out to sit and meet with a planner. I think the biggest trouble we run into with financial decisions is that we're not out there having somebody else give us unbiased advice. And it's hard to separate those emotions from your investment decisions. So those are... That would be my primary recommendation, is to actually find someone to meet with and help you handle those situations.
All right. Thanks, John.
Check out TSP.gov and check out the calculator, the TSP calculator. You learn a lot just by playing with the TSP calculator.
And check out NITPInc.com. Thank you, and we'll be back next week and for another great show. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.